Turning our attention to weather and climate on the show now with our two weather guys. On November 7th, there was a number of punch holes spotted in clouds around the Midwest. And maybe we can start with that as we visit with them. What are punch holes and what caused them? We'll also look ahead at the winter weather forecast with our two guests, Steve Ackerman, Vice Chancellor for research and grad education at UW-Madison, and also a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Steve, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Larry, how's it going?
It's going well. And, of course, John Martin, I think, is with us.
He's not with us yet.
He's not with us yet, but he will be. He's a professor.
He will be, right?
He's a professor and former chair of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Despite the fact that John's not with us, Steve is totally ready to answer your questions and comments, and I hope you'll join in. What do you want to know about the upcoming snow and temperatures? What about punch holes? Any unusual weather in your area? Have you got some cool photos of weather? We always love to see those as well. The number to call is 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. And if you got a photo, email them on to us. We'd love to have them. Well, Steve, let's start with punch holes. On November 7th, people saw multiple punch holes in clouds around the Midwest. And maybe you could describe for listeners, what are punch holes? What do they look like in the clouds?
Yeah, so what they look like in the clouds is it's a low-level cloud, usually goes horizon to horizon. It's kind of a stratus type of cloud. And it's generally uniform, except there's this really nice circle where it's cloud-free. And then sometimes in the center of that, you'll see a wispy cloud falling out of that clear center. So they got the nickname punch hole clouds because, you know, when we were growing up, you would have a piece of paper and you had that punch hole.
Yeah.
And you would, you know, make those things. It looks just like that, a nice little circle. And what it's caused by, it's a fascinating thing, I think, in the sense that these clouds are made of liquid water droplets and their temperature is below freezing. So they're super cooled. It's really hard to get small particles to form to an ice crystal. So they stay as a liquid water drop. It's just that their temperature is below freezing. And then if you can do something like shake them up, move them around, put other things into substances, into the like a exhaust from a plane, into the cloud, it converts them into a ice crystal. And the vapor pressure around an ice crystal is different than a liquid water drop. And so what happens is those ice crystals that initially form rapidly grow and then fall out of the cloud and they leave a hole. So what happens is a aircraft either ascending or descending through that cloud adds these nuclei that convert the supercooled liquid water droplet into an ice particle. And then that ice particle just rapidly grows, falls out, and you have a hole in the cloud. And it stays around for a while. It's in a satellite image, and from the ground, a number of people reported it, but you can only see one from the ground. If you look at a satellite image, you can see a whole bunch of these little punched out holes in the cloud deck all over the Midwest. It was really kind of a fun thing to look at.
Yeah, and right away I'm wondering, well, if it's below freezing, how come those water, I mean, they're super cooled, you said. I mean, why don't they turn?
Because to get an ice crystal to form, and this is one of the amazing properties of water, is that you have to get it into the right crystalline structure. And to get them to align so that they're going to form a crystal with six sides eventually is not that easy because they're randomly moving around. And so you need something that initiates it. And that's part of what we used to call cloud seeding. We would put in like silver iodide, which has a structure like an ice crystal, and then once you put that in a droplet, then the water molecules that are in the liquid form condense out and form that crystalline structure. But getting a crystalline structure is pretty hard to do.
That's really cool. And They're probably not very rare then, or are they rare, punch holes?
They're actually pretty rare, you know, because you need to have the super cold liquid water clouds. And sometimes, you know, they could be almost 40 degrees Celsius. So they can get really, really cold. The other thing is then you need an aircraft to go through it. And so if you're not near an airport, you know, you won't see it because, you know, these clouds are usually lower in the atmosphere. So they have to be near an airport. And, you know, in southern Wisconsin, there was, a lot of airports around that enabled aircraft to fly through them.
And there's a difference between freezing these small water droplets and freezing a larger body of water. There's a difference there for sure. Maybe you could explain that.
Yeah, so you can freeze a large body of water if you do it really, really slow. But like in our lakes and things like that, there are all kinds of particles in there that can serve as ice nuclei. And so once you get below freezing and you get a single ice crystal in there, that's just going to grow and everything's going to turn from liquid water into an ice. We call that glaciation. So you can stay as a below super cooled liquid water drop or small body of water. But once you start the crystal formation of an ice crystal, then it rapidly converts into a frozen lake or a ice crystal in the sky.
Phil in Hebron, Illinois, what's on your mind?
Hey, gentlemen. I have a quick question for you. I compare notes on a regular basis up here with Tom Skilling. I'm on the state line just below Lake Geneva. And including snowfall last winter and our rainfall all summer, we're at about a 36% below normal rainfall for the year. We moderated a little bit in October and now just went through November that was 25% of normal with moisture. My question is, what are the odds of that continuing into another growing season? What do the records tell us?
Wow.
Wow, that's a real good question.
And John's just joining us. Maybe we could have John Martin's chime in. John, you're there.
Yeah, I'm there, Larry. Yeah. I don't know what the records suggest in terms of, if you've had a dry prior summer and then a dry fall, what does it mean for the next spring and summer? And even if we did know what the answer was to that question, it may not be that it has any bearing at all on what comes in the coming growing season. So, you know, there's not really much connection between one prior growing season and the next one. In most instances, there's not any physical reason to understand the connection between the two. So I don't know if there really is much to say about that, except that, yeah, it's been exceptionally dry and persistently so down here. But I don't know if it's going to have a bearing on what we see next year.
Yeah. Anything to add there,
Steve? Seasonal forecasting is really tough to do. And so I would leave it, Phil, up to Tom Skilling. Ask him what he thinks it's going to be. He's a pretty good forecaster, at least day to day.
He's probably going to say the same thing, you think, John?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. Well, we've got both of our guests now with us, and you can join in as well. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us your question or maybe your weather photo to ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. John Martin, professor and former chair of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences Department at UW-Madison. Steve Ackerman, vice chancellor for research and grad education at UW, also a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. We got a whole lot more to talk with them about. I want to talk about making snow. I saw their article in the Wisconsin State Journal this morning. Making snow sounded pretty cool to me. If you're a skier, you're going to be interested. And even if you're not a skier, you're going to be interested. So stay with us. We'll take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back. Call in 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here taking a look at weather and climate with our weather guys, John Martin, professor and former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Steve Ackerman is also a member of that department as a professor, but he is also currently vice chancellor for research and graduate education at UW-Madison. So what do you want to know about clouds in the coming winter weather? Give a call, 800-642-1234, or send us an email with your question or photo to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. And Gene actually emailed a photo. I don't know if you guys can see it. She took the photo on November 7th, just north of Barneville. Is that a punch hole?
Yeah, I looked at that, and it looks like a punch hole. It looks like they really zoomed in with like a telephoto lens, because you don't get to see the other cloud decks around it, which would be 100% cloudy. But it looks that falling out section of that photo is definitely the ice crystals falling out.
Yeah, that's a nice one.
Yeah, that's a really nice picture, Gene. Thank you for sending it. Mitch in Green Bay will give you a chance. Hi, Mitch.
Hello. I had an interesting experience this summer. I grabbed a bottle, and I don't remember whether it was plastic or glass, out of the refrigerator with water in it. And I was quite thirsty, and I started to vacuum it out sort of fast. And I got a fairly decent-sized mouthful of it, and was just gulping it down, and I got to watch the ice crystals form and then start to run right through the bottle, and it all turned solid.
So it went from liquid to solid.
Yeah, that's what we were just talking about glaciation. I don't know. You must have a really cold fridge.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say. It must be well below zero C, yeah.
Very, very cool, Mitch.
If it's close to minus 10, that's exactly what you ought to expect.
Well, I've had that happen. It's been years, but I can remember that happening to me as well.
That's neat.
Yeah, that's. I think it happened. I think I was up north, and it was in November, and I may have had the bottle, the soft drink, sitting in some snow. Which would have been enough to do it.
Probably.
I would guess it was cold already. Mitch, thanks a lot. Appreciate the story. Randy in Hayward, let's go to you. Hi, Randy.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call, Larry. And thank you to the guest. A comment first and then a question. A comment is in my 31 years of gardening and living in the Namekagon River Valley, our last frost date, or the first killing frost, I should say, this fall was October 15th, which I have never seen before. Anyway, and my question is, you hear the term frost pockets once in a while. How do they form, and how do they move around, if you can address that? And I'll take your response off the air.
All right. Thanks, Randy. Frost pockets.
Yeah, so I think we had a really late frost, first frost date this year, too, throughout most of southern Wisconsin. It was really late, which was great because my flower garden really just kept in bloom.
Yeah, absolutely.
A frost pocket, I think what I'm thinking of when he says that word is it's something that occurs in the ground. And so it's water in the ground that then freezes and causes the ground to kind of elevate out as the frost comes out. That's kind of what I'm thinking about. I don't know if that's what Randy was referring to, though.
He might have been referring to, we should have kept him on. He might have been referring to a little area where here there's frost, and then, you know, over a little ways.
Okay. That's what I thought he might mean by that. So, and that would account for it moving around a little bit from one day to the next. So you've got to get temperatures and moisture conditions precisely at the right spot to start forming frost. And that, surprisingly, that's highly variable in small regions. You can be on a ball field and have a hill next to it. And the hill, you can actually see cold air coming down in the form of sort of condensate. And then maybe one spot on the ball field will be the place where you get frost. And it has to do with the radiation that's leaving that portion of the surface and the rate at which it's cooling and all that. Boy, it's really complicated. So that might be what he's referring to.
That makes a lot more sense, given where weather people are not geologists or soil scientists.
Yeah.
All right, there you go, Randy. Thank you so much for calling. Again, you can join in 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Well, people are wondering what the winter forecast for Wisconsin's looking like. A lot of us have enjoyed some pretty mild weather so far.
Yeah, and I think
October
that's what we're looking for with La Nina still going on. We've been really, really dry throughout most of the Midwest.
Yep. For a long time. Yeah. And we had a warmer than normal October and then just about an average November. And the hemisphere was about average for the second half of November, too, at this time of year. And so that's unusual. That hasn't been true for very many recent years. So I don't really, I don't know. It's kind of a mixed signal for me. I have no sense at all what November means, either at the surface or whatever it means a mile above the ground in terms of what comes for the rest of the winter. But we're only the 13th or 15th warmest winter thus far from October 1st till this point. So we're still, you know, way above 15 out of 73 years. So we're still way above the average, and even with a relatively cold November. So I guess I don't hold out much hope for a desperately cold winter.
Yeah. And the La Nina again, maybe just explain why that would make any difference at all.
Well, the La Nina is a case where the tropical Pacific ocean temperatures are cooler than normal. So what it does is it kind of squashes what would otherwise be a region of thunderstorms in the central Pacific. And those thunderstorms can transport not only water vapor, but more importantly, angular momentum, change the complexion of the jet stream over both the central Pacific basin and North America. So they can have a big effect over a prolonged period of time on, in this case, probably making the jet stream a little bit displaced in an unusual position compared to an El Nino year, which makes us definitely warmer than normal. La Nina, it's a little bit more of a mixed bag, so it's hard to say.
Let's take another call. Sierra in Madison, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm hearing a lot about these atmospheric rivers now, and I was wondering if this is going to be part of the, you know, the new normal until we solve the climate change issue. And is this related to what people used to call these training storms that is also a new phenomenon? Thanks for your time.
Yeah, so I'll start with the atmospheric rivers. And I say it at the same time, and the training storms. Neither of these are new phenomena.
Yeah.
So these are phenomena that have been around forever. We do tend sometimes to put new names on certain features that we see in the atmosphere because that's usually a function of we're measuring them with a little bit more acuteness. We're paying more attention to a particular structure and a particular evolution of a structure. I think that's really true with the atmospheric rivers. What happens in these instances, and there's one bearing down perhaps on the northwest of the United States this week, is that the tropics and the extratropics interact on occasion. They don't do it routinely. And when they do interact in a substantial way, what happens is the extratropical part of the circulation tends to drag the tropical moisture, especially poleward in the hemisphere. But that's always tied to the development of a really robust cyclone, and the warm tropical air comes up ahead of the cold front. So these are all old ideas that we've kind of relabeled as atmospheric rivers. Whether or not they're more prevalent now than ever is still not even determined. I think what we're trying to do is rate the threat that they pose to populated areas in a way that makes them sound like they're a brand new idea. But I don't think that they're any more prevalent now than they used to be. It's just that I think the occasionally extreme example of one, given that the land in the west coast of the United States has been more developed now than it was 50 years ago, and you get heavy rain on more developed land, you're going to have more landslides. So it's really hard sometimes to separate, is it just the way we're managing our land? Is it a new weather phenomena? And I think I would come down on the side that it's not probably a new weather phenomenon. And the training thunderstorms are a smaller scale. They're just kind of local. They might spread across the state of Iowa, let's say, instead of all the way up and down the west coast. And they're not often, or always, I should say, tied to a cold front.
Yeah, and that phrase atmospheric river, while we've been using it for many, many years as meteorologists, it's been said a lot over the last weekend.
Yeah.
I think in the news reports, I've heard it more than I've actually said that word in the last 3 months. So it's become a very popular phrase, much like polar vortex was a couple of winters ago.
Yeah.
I think you get people who are, you know, their business is to keep you interested in the news. Our business is to tell you how nature is working. And there's some overlap, but there's a lot of places where there isn't overlap. And this is one of them, you know, the prevalence of these terms. They're designed to get your attention. They're not designed to educate.
And it wasn't just too long ago, a few weeks back, where, you know, I'm thinking about all the drought and everything out west. And then the coast there, was it Washington or Oregon, got just deluged.
Yeah. Oregon and Northern California, I think it was the
Oregon
worst
and North, Northern California.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just deluged with a lot more water than they wish they'd have gotten a lot earlier, some of it
at
least.
You know, if you could take it as you need it, you know, sort of like when a baseball team wins 14-1, you'd love to store 12 of those runs for another day when you can't score. But that's just not how it works.
And when you get that downpour after a forest fire, I mean, there's nothing to hold that soil in place. And it's just.
Right.
You
know.
Claire in Sauk County, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. Thank you. I kind of have a follow-up question that relates to just what the guys were talking about. I called a few programs ago about the wasteful water at the water fountains in Las Vegas. And one of the experts said that the water goes into the atmosphere and basically comes back down within 9 days. And now I'm thinking about the snow machines, all that water, and golf courses, all that water that gets used. But my question is, when it comes back down at some point, it's not necessarily going to come back down in the same spot, right? I mean, it gets moved around.
Exactly.
That's exactly right. That's the problem.
Yeah, those fountains in Las Vegas, I mean, it's so dry and they don't have the dynamics that as that water evaporates, it's going to move someplace else. So if it does precipitate, it's not going to be in the area where they're taking the water from.
Yep.
How far would it move?
Depends on the weather conditions on both the regional scale, like Steve said, if it's really dry, as it often is in the high terrain and in the desert of Nevada, then it's going to just evaporate and just be carried by the winds. And then if the winds are particularly strong, it might get carried a really long distance. And if those strong winds are tied up with a circulation, such as is often the case at various points along the jet stream, that might be enough rising motion to turn what was recently turned into water vapor back into some liquid or frozen water. And it'll fall out and ruin somebody's fishing trip up in Brainerd, Minnesota, or maybe even further to the east, you know, maybe somewhere in Newfoundland or something. So it's really hard to say.
Interesting question, though. Thank you. Jim in Platteville, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I just wanted to ask, all the climate change stuff that's talked about is based on computer modeling and so on. And yet when just asked a moment ago, I mean, we're talking about projecting years out. You were just asked about what this winter was supposed to be and basically gave I don't know. How can that be?
Yep. Yeah, there's two different things going on there. First of all, the projections about the climate, its diagnosis of its current state and how it might act 50 or 100 years ago, into the future are different questions. So we can diagnose the state of the climate right now and report from observations, not from simulations, that things are not the same today as they, and they're not trending in the same way and the same rapidity as they did 100 years ago. We know that from the data record. So that's one thing. And you draw from that a conclusion that the climate's changing more rapidly now than we've ever seen that before, not only in the instrumented record, but in the proxy record. Then you go to the simulations and say, what does that mean about what's happening in the future? And if you can put your finger on what the factor is that's made the climate change, and you can implement that factor in your models and make it increase the way that you've seen the increase in the observations, you can then maybe make a guess about what's going to happen in the very long term. Not about individual weather systems, because that's what you're asking about when we say we don't know what the winter's going to be. What will be the parade of weather systems across southern Wisconsin this winter? That's hard to say. Will there be more rain events than snow events 100 years from now. That's not so hard to say at this latitude. We can say that. So that's the kind of specificity difference between a weather forecast and a climate forecast.
Yeah, interesting. Thank you, Jim, for that question. Appreciate it. Cal in Sugar Camp, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I heard something alarming on NPR a few days ago, that larger cities in America are employing private weather forecasting companies to predict extreme weather events because they can't rely on NOAA. I'm wondering if Trump just destroyed NOAA and they're no longer able to be the top weather forecasting group in America. That's kind of frightening.
So, yeah, I just had read that, too. And I think there's a couple of things going on. One is the National Weather Service is still a really good forecaster. But I think the cities that are looking at hiring private companies are, one, going to rely on what the National Weather Service is predicting and making observations are. But I think they're also looking really locally so that if it really does rain heavy and they have to deal with subways or elevated trains, what does it really mean specifically for the city? But I think the overall forecast for a certain amount of precipitation is going to be really similar between the private company and the National Weather Service. I think what they're really looking at are the details that'll affect the infrastructure of the city.
You go ahead, John.
I think
John.
That's right. The Weather Service has a broad mandate to deliver weather forecast information to the nation and its biggest interests. And so does the broadest paintbrush, thickest paintbrush. But on the local scale, as Steve points out, the ramifications of the weather can really get onto the very local scale. They can't possibly keep track of all of that. And so they farm some of their information out to other companies who fill in that niche and make that forecast. A good example would be, the assembly plants, like the Belvedere assembly plant in Northern Illinois. The Weather Service doesn't tell them whether or not a hailstorm is coming in the next hour or so. Some private company comes in and says, here's what we see on our radar. Here's what the forecast is from the National Weather Service. They put that together and make that important call for the Belvedere assembly plant in Northern Illinois because they want to get those cars off the lot. But the Weather Service doesn't have that mandate. So it's easy to play games with the Weather Service reputation when you don't know that fact. But when you do know it, I think you can kind of see they have a different mandate.
Mark in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thanks for the opportunity. I understand that water vapor has to have a nucleation site, a virus, a dust mold, whatever. So during those days when we had all the smoke in the upper Midwest, why didn't it just settle out with water vapor? We'd get up in the morning, there'd been heavy dew, but we still had heavy smoke.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think the other part that we have to look at in forming a droplet or an ice crystal is how much relative humidity is in the air. And so in those situations, the relative humidity was, way below 80% or 90%. And so you're not going to have enough moisture to condense and form a liquid droplet.
Yeah. And then also some of the soot particles can be so big that it just isn't related, again, to what Steve said. There isn't enough water around to coat them. And if you can't coat the whole thing, then you can't fool the atmosphere. Then the atmosphere knows it's kind of half water and half soot, and it's not going to grow quite the same way as if it's fooled into thinking it's a giant water drop. So there's all kinds of tricks and limitations.
Mark, thank you. Mike in Fond du Lac wonders about the start of the next ice age, if there's one, and if so, when might it occur? It's his understanding ice age cycles have been somewhat repeatable over the last couple million years without global warming.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think that cycle is like 22,000 years.
Something like that.
Yeah. So maybe in 2,000 years, 20,000 years, I'm sorry.
Yeah. And, it's no surprise that these cycles have much longer timescales than the global warming one, because that one's based on industrialization. That's now beyond doubt, unequivocal in the IPCC recent report. And so that's only a 200-year-old process or so, 250 years, go back to 1750 or so. So, if you've got something operating on a 22,000-year timescale, 200 years of abrupt change to the chemical composition of the atmosphere is going to supersede that. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah, and the ice ages are coupled to how the Earth rotates around the sun, and so, or orbits the sun. And so that's on a much longer time scale, how that varies.
And someone wondered the difference between astronomical winter and meteorological winter.
One of my favorite topics. Astronomical winter is the winter solstice. So you could say and be right that winter starts on whatever day it is this year, December 21st or 22nd. On the other hand, it's going to snow later this week. You're going to say winter starts when you get your first inch of snow. So that's meteorological winter. And usually it doesn't relent. I mean, it might not get stone cold winter on the first time you get an inch of snow. But once it happens for the first time, you realize, forget 60 degree days, forget any of that stuff. No, put the shorts away. No more T-shirts until April. And you'd be wise to do so. So there's in an anecdotal way, that's the difference.
I guess climatology winter starts on December 1st. I guess it's the 3 months.
Yeah, that's
December,
also
January,
true.
February are classified as winter.
Yep, that's right. DJF, as they say.
Well, on that happy note, I think we've got a forecast for at least for the Madison area of 50 degrees yet once this week. So there's at least one more warm day before we get an
one
inches.
More day of fall, anyway.
Go out and wear your shorts then if you want to do that. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to join you.
I wish I had time to play golf that day. Thanks a lot, John and Steve. Appreciate it very much. John Martin, professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison, as is Steve Ackerman, who also happens to be vice chancellor for research and graduate education at UW-Madison. They'll be back last Monday of next month. We'll do it all over again. Thank you so much for listening. Tomorrow we have a show dedicated to books, and we'll look forward to that. Kathleen Ernst, one of our guests. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network.